Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOV, 1310 AM. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Dr. Leif Oxberg. He is the principal investigator at the Center for Molecular Medicine here in Maine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Oxberg.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Yes. There is, you know, when we first read about some of your work and the grant that was recently given to the Maine Medical Center Research Institute, I thought back to my experience in science in seventh grade with fond memories. My advancement stalled there, but it's a fascinating subject, and medicine and health is something critical to everyone, and research plays such a key role, so I definitely want to talk about all the scientific part. But why don't we start with a little bit of your background and what first brought you here to Maine and where you went to school, and then we'll talk about the research being done and kind of the breakthroughs that you're working on.
Sure, that sounds good.
So where did you... Your accent doesn't sound like Scarborough. I don't pick up any Biddeford.
Not this Scarborough.
Not different. A whole different Scarborough. Yeah. So you grew up in Sweden.
I grew up between Sweden and Scotland, in both. I went to school, well, high school in Scotland, in Edinburgh. And from there, I went on to university, back to Sweden. So I've been shuttling back and forth.
Great.
Spent about equal amounts of time in each of the countries now.
Do you go back?
Yeah. I go back to both Scotland and Sweden. Mm. I have friends and family in both. And now I actually have a lot of colleagues in both countries as well that I work with for work, you know, that I see for work.
I've spent some time in Finland. You ever go to Finland?
Yeah, actually.
I was trapped in the Helsinki airport a while back. I was on my way to Moscow, which it almost sounds like a TV show or something. I was on my way to Moscow, and the plane got diverted to Helsinki. Oh. You know, and we were stuck in the airport, and the only food they had were reindeer.
Well, the reindeer is particularly good there.
you don't hear that on the show very often. They're known for their reindeer there. If you got it in Switzerland, yes, it's a little gamey. But the reindeer in Helsinki, Finland,
Yeah, they eat it with horseradish.
Of course they do.
Very good. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. And that was in Iceland a while ago, and they actually eat horse.
Sheep's heads. And rotten fish.
Yeah, you would almost think this was a culinary show, the way that I digress.
Almost.
Yeah, very, very appetizing. So what brought you to America? I'm guessing academics and school?
That's right. After I finished my PhD in Sweden, I decided to come over here. I was offered a place in a lab at Harvard, and I worked with a professor there for 4.5 years, learning a lot about genetics before I came up to Maine and started my own lab.
And genetics and molecular science is really the root of everything in life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I did my PhD on the genetics of viruses, of flu virus, and understanding how the flu virus changes from season to season, which is a big, you know, problem for vaccine development and
right.
You know, why we have these recurring epidemics of flu.
Since you're bringing it up, and since we're in February, and since about 11% of our audience has the flu, well, why don't we digress there a little bit? Because I think that's interesting. And people, I think, are familiar where every fall and winter, when the CDC or whoever oversees the vaccine, it's typically a cocktail of bird flu virus. And every year it changes based on modeling and what's happening around the world.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit about the science of the flu and how the vaccine works, and is there more research being done that's bringing us closer to not eradicating, but being able to treat the virus or prevent the virus? It feels like every year it's a little bit of rolling the dice.
Yeah.
Did we get the right vaccine? Did we not? So if you wouldn't mind talking about the flu.
Absolutely. No, I think it's been very interesting for many years. And the reason that flu changes so easily is that it has a very mutatable genetic material. So the genes inside the flu virus mutate all the time. And really what we're seeing in development of new flu virus strains is Darwinian selection. So basically evolution. It's evolving at a massively higher rate than we are, unfortunately.
Wow.
So every year a new strain or several new strains evolve, which we have less or no, in some cases, protection against. because the immune response that we have is against previous years.
But relative to modern science, how much change is happening? And is it happening at a constant rate, or is it accelerating because of the evolutionary kind of effect?
No, I think what's happening is that we are seeing, we're seeing a more or less constant rate. The real driver of the evolution is the density of the population and how much transmission there is.
Higher density, more quicker transmission, yep. Whereas we were more rural and it would take more time to
exactly.
spread.
Yeah, and that's the basis of why, in Mongolia, for example, they have very few problems with these communicable diseases that we have in denser populations.
Right. It's another good reason why, my no handshake or hug policy. Deb, you know this firsthand, right?
I do.
I mean, for years, every time we greet each other, you've been going for the hug.
I do. I'm a hugger.
And
I'm
I give you the Heisman.
Yeah.
I give you. Yeah. I write a newspaper column, and maybe one of the most controversial columns I wrote was a few months ago, where I took a pretty strong position against hugging.
In general.
Okay. In general. Not specific to the flu. The flu was one
There's
of
no, not just.
Not just Deb.
No, okay.
No, because that would be there was a component.
Yeah, singling people out is not good.
Yeah, it's not good because I don't want Deb to feel that way.
Yeah.
But we as a society, I don't know in Sweden and in your experience, but the hugging thing in America has gotten out of control. It used to be for close family members,
right.
And it used to be for close colleagues. And now you meet somebody in a meeting at 2 o'clock, and at 3 o'clock they get up and want to hug you.
Maybe that's just you, because I really
nobody wants to hug
doesn't
you.
Happen to me that you, often.
Again, we've just met, so I don't want to take too much personal liberty. But you seem huggable.
But
to me, but as a scientist, maybe people finding you very standoffish, and then you have that whole academic Harvard thing,
which
creates a barrier, bit of an academic elite barrier. but we digress. So relative to the flu, how's this year's flu vaccine? Do they track the success rate and how it's working and how are we doing on this year's
and
flu?
I think this year there is very little flu, comparatively speaking. I think because of the season, there are many different things, but weather, etc., late,
right.
Winter, really. And I think this season is relatively mild, and there are a few cases in the clinic.
By the way, we have Dr. Leif Oxberg. He's the principal investigator at the Center for Molecular Medicine here in Maine. Why are chicken eggs particularly effective in terms of incubating flu vaccine?
Right. So the chicken egg is...
As opposed to other eggs,
The
other platforms or vehicles to create the vaccine.
Yeah, well, the chicken, it's actually not the egg, it's the embryo. So it's an embryonated chicken egg in which this virus grows like mad. And it grows to huge quantities in those eggs, partly because it's difficult to say exactly why, but we think that flu virus originated as a bird infection among birds.
Transmitted by birds flying
around?
Two birds.
Yeah, and they can live with it perfectly normally. Many birds don't get sick, and it's transmitted...
They don't call into work and say, I'm not going to migrate.
No pecking today.
No pecking. I'm not feeling up for it.
Yeah. But some of the theories around how flu virus ended up in humans is that, the close relationship between chickens, ducks, migratory waterfowl, and human beings in rural villages led to that transmission.
Yeah, I don't go near ducks either.
Don't hug ducks.
Yeah, because they're all over the place. That just supports your whole thing. They're transient. It's like you see a duck at a pond, and it feels so nice, like pet-like, but you don't know where that duck's been.
No, you never know where they've been.
You never know.
Yeah.
We have Dr. Leif Oxberg here. He's principal investigator, Center for Molecular Medicine, and one of the most academically accomplished guests we've ever had here on the show. Let's get to what brought you to Maine first, and then talk a little bit about what your group does at the Maine Medical Research Institute, and then we'll talk about some of the specific programs, specifically how to grow a kidney in a lab is part of the science that you're working on. But what first brought you to Maine? And after your academic studies down in Boston at both Tufts and Harvard, what was the impetus to say, let's go north 100 miles and see what's going on in Maine?
Well, I did, like I said, I did my work at Harvard, working in the lab of a professor there, studying genetics. And at the end of that period, I really wanted to start my own lab, be independent. And so I was looking around, and they, at the time, the Maine Medical Center Research Institute was relatively new, and it was a very exciting environment. Well, it still is a very exciting environment, but right then it was still recruiting brand new groups.
Almost in an incubator phase, kind of a pun because you deal with incubators
true.
In science.
Yeah, we have a lot of incubators.
So when did it first start? And talk a little bit about the scope of the Institute now in terms of how many people, how many research scientists
right.
in the structure.
So it's an interesting year. It's the 25th anniversary of Maine Medical Center Research Institute. And it started with a couple of people with some big ideas to make a research institute in the Portland area. And the ball got rolling, I think. You know, the first group of people might have been five or six, but recruiting more and more and more. And the building that we're in right now was built in about 2002. And I came in 2004. So
and
the building
down
was
in
relatively
Scarborough, right?
That's in Scarborough, yeah. And it was a, you know, state-of-the-art research facility that was built strictly for research. And so the hospital, Maine Medical Center, decided it wanted to put its research effort into one organization instead of having it spread out across the hospital.
And how does that work? And how does the affiliation with Maine Med work? And how is the funding all under the umbrella of Maine Med, or are the research grants that you go out and seek independently specific for research?
Yes, exactly. That's how it works. So we have, we're supported by the hospital. We're a hospital department, so we're part of Maine Med. And so the revenue stream really comes in partly from the hospital and partly from independent research grants that go to each of the different labs in the center.
Interesting. So let's talk about some of the work. And I'm also looking down here. I want to bounce around a little bit because I think it's fascinating, the work that you're doing. Some of the committees as a scientist that you are affiliated with and some of the research you're working on, it shows here your chief science coordinator for solving organ shortage.
That's right.
And that has to do with, is that synthesizing or growing from stem cell organs or deep, deep molecular research where we're looking to grow organs?
It's actually not, it's not an organization in which we are doing research. It's an organization in which we're trying to organize all of the different people who are interested in growing new kidney tissue and to make a funding mechanism that will allow us to get, you know, money in from investors to put into science. And so the idea there is basically to create a focus on solving organ shortage for lung, liver, kidney right now, and also heart.
I show in my notes that more than 4,000 people in the U.S. died in the last year, in 2014, while waiting for kidney transplants.
Right.
And it feels like from the research of your research that I've looked at that kidney science is something you're particularly focused on, is both a need and kind of the particular science. And much of the research is derived from stem cell.
Right.
Is that for our listeners, by the way, we have Dr. Leif Oxberg here. He is a scientist, chief investigator. Talk a little bit. I think people hear stem cell in a political context.
Right.
And there's some controversy that's been politicized. But from a scientific standpoint, if you wouldn't mind talking about what are stem cells and how, in your opinion, they're vital to research for some of the breakthroughs that you're working on and that are happening in the science world
sure.
in general.
And I think the science and the ethics go hand in hand with stem cells. The first stem cells that we had were derived, or that were available, were derived from human embryos. And a stem cell really is a cell that can become any cell in your body. Those are the cells that we start with immediately after fertilization when we're embryos.
It's the most base level of the foundation that contains all the DNA and all the molecular information before they evolve into specialized cell groups.
That's right. And that process is known as differentiation. And really what happens during that differentiation process is that parts of the certain genes are activated, other genes are inactivated, and they stay in that state. And really what the stem cell is a cell that has a state for each gene that can be programmed any way you want it to. And that's why they're so important in the lab. But the ethical concerns around the use of stem cells originated because of the origin in embryos. But that's no longer the case, because now we know how to make stem cells from adults. And so a lot of the controversy, ethical controversy, is now moot.
A non-issue.
Yes.
And so the research that you do at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute, you're using adult stem cells?
Yes. So stem cells that come out of an adult and are reprogrammed back to stem cell state.
Wow. And I don't want to get too technical again. The limit of seventh grade science, that's the limiting point on my understanding. But are there different cell groups in an adult where stem cells are very specifically located, or can you go down to the molecular level, the DNA level of almost any like skin cell, or does it have to be one area of the body where you're able to harvest adult stem cells?
No, so this was a breakthrough, and it was the scientist or scientists who made this discovery won the Nobel Prize in 2012. And the basic finding was that you could take any cell, a differentiated cell, a skin cell, a cheek swab cell, an epithelial cell from your urine, because we secrete cells, and put a cocktail of genes into that cell that reprogrammed it and put that cell back into stem cell state. It's a relatively inefficient process. It occurs in a fraction of a percent of the cells that you harvest, but it does occur in that fraction of a percent. And if you can isolate that cell and grow it, you've got yourself a stem cell that's very similar to the stem cell that you find at the beginning of embryonic development.
Fascinating. We have Dr. Leif Augsburg. He's the principal investigator, which is, as Dr. Augsburg explained, is a scientific term used in research. Talk about the specific work being done that has gotten a lot of attention and a lot of press, having to do with trying to grow kidneys from stem cells. I think in the last year there was a $6.8 million federal grant for research that was given to your institute. And talk about where you are in the process and where you hope to get, is the Holy Grail creating organs limited to kidney, but other organs are also, I'm sure, just as important and just as vital. But talk a little bit about, from a scientific standpoint, where the research is now and where you think it should or could be going, and what's the timeline for that?
Right. So the Holy Grail is an analogy that's good and bad. The bad part of it is that they never found it and they died trying.
Oh, the whole... I watch Indiana Jones.
Oh, that he 3. Found it, right?
Yeah. I get my science from Steven Spielberg. And,
okay.
And I believe, Deb, you remember when when Indiana Jones, and then before, who was that sidekick of Indiana Jones? He turned, we digress, but he turned into kind of the kid who was the nut job on Transformers.
I don't know.
And now he's... Yeah.
Do you know him?
See,
Shia LaBeouf?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't remember what his character was.
Yeah, yeah, but he's faded into oblivion. That's why you don't know him. It's well-deserved, by the way. So the Holy Grail, now that we've established that only in fiction have they found it, but the Holy Grail, relative to your research and using stem cell to grow a kidney?
We the details remain to be worked out. Are we going to grow a kidney or are we going to assemble a kidney? We don't know those things yet. But what we do know is that we have proof of principle experiments that show it's feasible to get cells from a stem cell state into a kidney cell state. And there are many different kidneys, cells in the kidney. But we can make them take that step from stem cell to kidney cell. And we can grow those kidney cells and make them form the types of structures that we see in a kidney. That's all happened during the past few years. So we have proof of principle experiments that show that. Now the big challenge is to get those structures to appear in an organized way. The kidney is a tremendously organized organ, and its function depends on its three-dimensional organization. And so now the challenge is partly an engineering challenge and partly a biological challenge, and we need to work together by biologists and engineers to assemble all of the different cell types onto some form of scaffold that's going to allow us to make an organ of the appropriate size. What happens when you pile cells up into a lump is that they will grow to a certain size, but they'll stop growing because they don't have an adequate blood supply. And in order to get that blood supply, you need to scaffold them out and provide conduits just like plumbing. You need to provide conduits throughout that scaffold for them to get a blood supply to get nutrients and oxygen.
Why, again, I want to talk in more detail in terms of the research you are doing and the other folks in the Institute, but why is your research specific to kidneys, as opposed to other organs and other groups around the country, or is there something specific to the organized gene mapping of kidney that just is it the easiest organ to use as a base for this type, or is it something where you just happen to really like kidney research, or is there somebody looking at heart research or somebody working in lung or somebody working in liver or other organs where there's also critical need?
Yeah, absolutely. There are research groups working in all those areas. I'm particularly interested in the kidney because, my background has been studying how the kidney develops. For these past 15 years, I've been interested in studying how the embryonic development, normal development of the normal kidney occurs and all of the steps that those cells take during that differentiation process. And really what I want to do now is to reverse engineer that.
Right,
and that's my goal. But there are people working on lung, liver, pancreas, and all these different organs that we need to make, new ones for transplantation purposes. And the one that probably is closest to the clinic. Well, actually, no. I'll tell you that right now there's a clinical trial going on in Japan, the first in the world of stem cell derived tissue going in back into a human patient. And that's a lady in her 70s who's got macular degeneration, which is a common age related disease where you lose basically the base of your eye.
Right.
And so the research team or the clinical research team really have taken her cells from her own body, reprogrammed them back into the stem cell state and differentiated them forward into a retina, and they've actually implanted that retina now, and that was a few months ago.
And that's one of the first.
That's the first
applications of taking the science and taking the stem out, and then engineering, and then putting it back in.
Yeah, it's a huge. It's actually a huge step forward in this field that we call regenerative medicine.
talk a little bit about nephrons. And from the research and from the background we have here, It says that each kidney has between 500,000 and 1,000,000 nephrons, and you've built approximately 50 nephrons in the lab, and feels like you're a little ways away from the million, but the longest journey starts with a single step.
That's how we like to see it. Yeah,
yeah. And that you've achieved results already, where you've grown a tiny part of a kidney, and the kidney tissue that you've produced in the lab is approximately 0.1 millimeter, and you could only see it under a microscope. And even backing up a little bit, you know, the kidney is a vital organ. And pretty much in humans, everything, I think, except the tonsils or maybe the appendix, are vital. But the kidney, you know, that's the organ that filters waste from the blood.
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about the mechanics of the kidney and why that's critical, and then talk about what you've created in the lab.
Okay.
And what a nephron is.
Right. So the kidney actually does its most common function, or most widely known function, is the filtration, because we build up this substance called urea in our blood. We need to get rid of that. And we also need to retain fluids, retain the right amount of fluids. And those two functions are well known for the kidney. But the kidney also regulates blood pressure, and it also controls production of red blood cells. So if you have kidney failure, your blood pressure goes crazy and you become anemic. Mm-hmm. And so there are many, many different effects, in addition to becoming basically poisoned by the toxins that are building up in your own blood. So the kidney has many, many, many functions that are essential to just to keep us feeling normal and healthy. And so when you lose it, because the kidney doesn't normally regenerate, nature has provided us with a massive overcapacity. And so we can lose a large part of our kidney mass in general and still live perfectly normal lives. And that's why people can donate a kidney. Live donation is common. And there are no known adverse long-term effects of donating a kidney. So you can be perfectly fine with one. But when you get
down to we have two? Is that?
We have two.
We have two, and they're typically the plumbing, so they're in serial. So,
no, they operate in parallel.
Really?
So, yeah.
So, yeah, and you hear about, I think people anecdotally hear about, or obviously families that they're facing having a family member that needs a kidney or is having kidney failure, I'm sure knows the science of it. But your point is that there's redundancy in nature. So they,
absolutely.
So through evolution, through Darwin, if you believe in that kind of thing, we've evolved. Like the kidney's really important. So let's have two.
Let's have a lot.
Let's have extra kidneys. But so if a person needs to donate a kidney,
yep.
And it's the right match, and obviously it has to be the right blood type, and it has to be the right science to it. You know, one side of the kidney is basically sewn off, and that kidney can be transplanted into another person, and then both the donor and the person receiving the kidney. You know, one kidney is enough to do the filtration needed.
Yeah, and the individual who receives the kidney feels, you know, immediately about a million times better. And, because the kidney, the dialysis process that we have, when people end up in kidney failure, dialysis takes care of filtering out the toxins from the blood, but it doesn't really take care of all of the other things that the kidney does.
Is there a mechanical function to the kidney, or is it basically filtration through cellular structure?
It's filtration. It's filtration based, but it's the basis. And this is getting to your question about the nephron. So it looks like a parallel array of tubes. So blood filters at one end, and then in each tube has a blood filter at one end, and then the filtrate that passes basically is sieved across a porous membrane, so that all the blood cells are retained on the blood site, but all the fluid and the small molecules pass over into this tube, and that tube is known as the nephron. And when that primitive urine passes through the tube, all sorts of things happen to it, because the sieve just lets is pretty indiscriminate in what it lets out. And a lot of those things we want back. We want certain ions back, and we want certain substances back, and we definitely need to bring water back. Because one of the problems with living on land is, as we do, is that we we need to conserve water, or we will dehydrate. And if we just get rid of everything that filters out, then we would dehydrate really quickly.
Is anyone who's been on a boat lost at sea for over 100 days knows that water is the more vital element for survival than food?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, we've learned
that.
Everybody
knows that. Everybody
knows that. Tom Hanks, I think, taught us that too from...
sure did.
Yeah, from Castaway. Yeah.
But very frustratingly, when you are at sea, unless you're in a freshwater lake, the water is undrinkable.
I thought that too. And there was some case of someone down in Central America who was lost at sea for like 200 or 300 days. And he drank lots of different liquids, some body liquids, but some... He once in a while had to drink ocean water, and he actually survived.
And he survived it?
Yeah. Wow. Well, it may be a Ripley's Believe It or Not. Some people have said not. But the bottom line is, you know, 80-90% of the cell structure in the human body is water, right? So water is a base component of everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, talk about your kidney tissue that you've grown that's 0.1 millimeter. And is it still growing? And what's the science of growing a piece of kidney? And it's fascinating. How temperature sensitive is it? Where is it getting its nutrition as a cell growth to continue growing and evolving?
So we're very proud of this little lump.
Is there one little lump? Is it like
It's a lump that we can. This lump takes about 7 days to make. And after that 7 days, we can maintain it in the lab for a while. And then we haven't tried to grow it for long periods of time. What we're focusing on is how we can generate more of it and more of it. Bigger mass and in a more organized way. And this is the project that I'll describe a bit about how we got there. And so I had some very talented people working in my lab. Among them, Aaron Brown, who's a scientist who's now independent and works at MMCRI, has his own lab now. And a long series of Ulrika Blank. And there were a lot of scientists who worked with me and trained with me who made this happen. And we have now grown these pluripotent stem cells, as you know, adult-derived stem cells, and figured out the sequence of events that they need to go through once they become progenitor cells from the kidney to become these nephrons. And so they become, they organize themselves, we need to give them nutrients, we do all of this in a culture dish, as it's known. We need a specific gas tension, we need a certain carbon dioxide blend. There are a lot of different variables here, and a part of the work that we've been doing over the past few years is really testing those out meticulously, one by one, in large matrices, and trying to say, you know, this is the combination that we want of, you know, these electrolytes and this gas blend and this, you know.
So basically getting the environment right.
Exactly.
That will grow the cell material.
Yep.
and probably to approximate as close as you can the human environment where
right.
these particular cells are native to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that really was the finding that we made, that we
I
could make a niche.
Scientific right
you
there.
You did.
Even after just seventh grade science, it feels, you know... And I didn't go to Tufts or Harvard or.
Well, you're making me feel bad.
Well, I'm not trying. We don't do
I
that.
I didn't need all those.
I know. All it took
other years
was Needham High School.
Yeah.
In between wood shop and square dancing, I fit in a little biology, a little science.
Right.
By the way, we have Dr. Leif Oxberg. He's the principal investigator at the Center for Molecular Medical at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute down in Scarborough doing some breakthrough work. So what are the next steps? So first of all, you applied for a grant, and I think that's kind of a fascinating element because we're at a period now in both our kind of political environment and I think in terms of maybe it's the political climate that's driving it where science, it isn't good enough just to have something that's scientifically viable, like, I don't know, climate change or what's happening with isotopes in the Antarctic. We're in an environment where all it takes is a group of people saying, I don't believe in that or I don't support that. And, you know, gravity, well, maybe there's gravity, maybe there's not.
Yeah.
How does your work, which has been probably the most advanced research type of work that you and your group are doing, how does that work in today's kind of political environment having to do with science? And how did that intersect the grant, the $6 million, whatever it was, grant from last summer to do the research? And where do you think we are in terms of the U.S. government, in terms of recognizing and investing enough, literally and figuratively, in this kind of really important science?
I think finding funding is a very sort of fickle process. You go through a lot of trial and error. And I think at the basis of our funding is really in the National Institutes of Health, which is the federally funded institute that, you know, distributes money for this type of work. And the National Institutes of Health has been going for a long time now. It's a very, it's a fantastic organization. It has a lot of very clever people in it making very clever decisions about what, you know, to prioritize.
But not political, just scientific
people. It's not
political. People. There's agenda.
Exactly.
There's no...
And the agenda is really how well funded should the NIH be. And that is the political agenda. And for the past, I don't know what it is, 10 years, no one's been able to really decide on a budget for it. So we've had this continuing resolution process where the NIH has been funded as much as it was last year. But that's really not... worked because it means that there's been really a
it's negative.
It's been negative about 30%
and all the overhead and salaries, everything else advances.
Inflation goes up, but the dollar amount stays the same. And so this past year, they actually passed a budget, and they passed a budget with an increase for the NIH. So I think it's one of those issues that politically, I think everybody can get around this. From both sides, can get around the need for medical research. And it's not really a contentious topic in terms of, do you want this to happen? Do you not want this? I mean, no one's going to say no, right?
Right. Well, so, it depends. There was the philosophical, ideological argument that was probably attached to some of the early stem cell research.
Oh, that, yes.
That was embryonic.
Absolutely, yes, that was. Yep.
But once the science has moved past that.
Yes.
Then it really does feel it's a pure issue of, you know, we need to advance in this science because it's a common interest in terms of extending life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's so many people who are not getting organ transplants that's something we need to address. I mean, I've not really talked right now, in our discussion about the timeline here. I don't want to give anybody the impression that this is going to happen next month. I mean, we're talking about a 20-year timeline here, at least until we can get something into the clinic that can help somebody. But if we don't, you know, that's 20 years from when we start. So if we start in 10 years, it's 30, you know, but if we start today, that might help people who, you know, are currently in their 30s and have polycystic kidney disease, for example. And that's a real prospect for maybe some people.
I know it's not your focus as a research fellow and as the principal investigator is on the biology and the science and the molecular, but has advancements been done in dialysis on the mechanical side? Because that's a component in terms of prolonging life. People have kidney disease waiting for a transplant. And what's the state of that in terms of the medical support systems for people that are facing kidney disease?
I think a lot of advances have been made in how dialysis is done. Can you do it at home? Can you do it at night? Can you do it? You know, people have tested out different ways of doing dialysis. The basic chemistry of dialysis, taking urea out of the blood, hasn't really changed very much. There are things in development that might change that. There are semi-biological variants of dialysis that are in clinical trials in which the blood is filtered not only over a chemical cassette that takes out the urea, but also over cells, kidney cells outside the body that have a certain function in exchanging certain substances that you need exchanged that the kidney normally does. So
live cells supplement the mechanical filtration.
Exactly. And that's still in trials. It's not commercially available yet, but it's a strategy that's sort of halfway in between dialysis and new tissue for transplantation, you know?
Well, we have Dr. Leif Oxberg, and clearly both in terms of academic achievement and science and real-world science, he is the smartest guy in the room from where we speak. And I love talking about science.
I'm glad.
It is kind of the root element that is about life.
That's right. Yeah. No, that's
yeah, we should
exciting.
All be interested in science.
Well,
we should
hope.
Be involved the environment. We should. We're on this planet hurling through space at 35,812 miles per hour. A, we should be taking care of the planet, which is another discussion. B,
right.
We should be making sure we're insulated from solar, which is a climate issue. And we should be taking care of our bodies.
Absolutely. And, every day there's a new phenomenally interesting scientific fact, like yesterday's discovery or announcement of the gravitational waves.
Yeah, wasn't that supporting Einstein's theory?
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of, they've identified there's a wave effect in terms of, was it the black hole? Or
matter shrinks. Yeah, these two black holes collided. And far off, they're like 39 times the size of our solar system. Far off, and they collided, and they caused this gravitational waves that rippled through the cosmos and caused matter to slightly change shape.
I mean, that's
kind of interesting.
That's sort of interesting. Right up there with Dr. Seuss, Horton and the Who, where I have a grandson who loves Horton and the Who, and that we could have a whole nother civilization on one little speck right here on the table, and there could be a million live organisms just in a whole different dimension and size.
Maybe the kidney that we currently have that's 50 nephrons could be of use to them.
Maybe it's the perfect size.
Yes.
It may be too big because, again, you get your medical info from, all these academic institutions, and I get mine from Dr. Seuss. In the next few minutes, I think the work that you're doing at the research facility and affiliated with MaineMed is just fascinating, and I wish you lots of luck. Looking in, I have a broader question that we kind of touched upon when we talked about the flu a little bit, and that is two questions. One, as a scientist, this is throwing kind of a morality issue at you, which here at the Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, we like to do that in the last couple of minutes to create maximum guest discomfort. And then the second is specific. So the morality issue is you're doing advanced research in your studies both in Europe and Tufts and Harvard. You're on a day-to-day basis, you're working with other scientists, and much of your research is focusing on human components of whether it's the research for kidneys or other areas. Do you think that there will become a point, and there's some discussion about that now, where the science, the biology, the pharmaceutical support will take human life further, older than is kind of the natural parameter? And what that means is, as a person in my 50s, who I can see 70 and 80 in the horizon, hopefully, knock on wood. But at some point, we're developing science that is taking the human body beyond kind of the design parameters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's creating, I think, moral issues, ethical issues, and hate to say it, but economic issues.
Right.
Because, you know, within the continuum of life for people who are in their 80s, generally 10 to 40 or 50% of their healthcare costs are in the last 5% of their lives.
Right.
Because we're having machines, we're having mechanical advancements, we're having drugs. And I don't know if there's enough discussion about that. And it kind of intersects the healthcare discussion in terms of Affordable Care Act and what should be in the program and what not. And it's been politicized as death squads. But where in the process of scientists and academians and philosophers are there people sitting around thinking, where is the continuation, kind of the natural parameter that is both good for the individual and good for society terms of, you don't want to put cost benefit on life because every person's life is valuable.
Yeah.
But in an organized society, you have to look at all the elements. And if we're extending the natural lifespan to 90 to 100 to 110, but maybe the quality of life isn't as great, but the expense for the rest of society is significant. Does that ever enter the realm of discussions when you and the other scientists get together and talk about these things?
Yes, it does. And I think that the focus, the goal that I think most of us have is to have a better old age, not a longer old age.
Right.
But an old age in which you could, you know, because there are so many people in their 70s, which is relatively young today. 70s is a fairly young age.
I'm looking 70s right in the eye, and I agree with you. Back when I was in my 20s, it would be like, you know, the 70s just feels like Jurassic era.
Yeah, and you know, people who were in their 70s when I was a kid, they were really old. And they were old. They were more worn down, I think, than people are in their 70s now.
Well, it's nutrition, exercise, information, medicine.
We know so much more.
Right.
And we take care of ourselves a lot more. It could be a lot better. But I think that what everybody's aiming for is a better old age. I think that the primary goal isn't really to extend that lifespan. And extending the lifespan beyond sort of
The design parameters?
Yeah, the design parameters isn't anybody's goal. It's a maybe unfortunate effect of what we're doing, because I think when we say we want people to live, have an enjoyable old age, enjoy their 80s,
right?
Maybe we're pushing that unenjoyable 10 years further.
Yeah.
that's a hard dilemma, and I don't know how to, an answer.
I'd be happy to enjoy my 70s and just hang in there in my 80s. So, you know, maybe my perspective will change in 20 or 30 years, hopefully.
Yeah.
I'll get to that point. But at this point, if I can enjoy 50s, if I think 60s are all right and 70s is like, 70s are all right. I'm playing bingo and I'm hanging out a little bit, going for walks. Maybe I'll be feeding the ducks. Maybe I'll be hugging people.
Don't hug ducks, though.
Do not. Yeah. That's the bad combination. But if I get to the 80s, just want to hang in there.
Yeah.
Just want to kind of, you know, don't have expectations of going skydiving. Don't have expectations. Just,
There's a very interesting study going on in New York, and I can't remember at which hospital. One of the oldest people, I think he died a couple of years ago, unfortunately, at the age of 106. But he was a manager. I can't remember his name, but he ran a Wall Street investment firm until he was 104.
Really?
Working 6 days a week. So some people have the capacity.
You hear about African cultures or small tribes where something about diet and something about natural environment, where you have clusters of people exposed to modern medicine or chemicals or additives, you hear that. I've never really heard the Wall Street guy theory.
It's amazing, actually. And there's a group at one of the hospitals in New York who's following all these people in the United States who live these abnormally long lives in perfect health and a perfectly normal mental state.
Yeah, there was 60 Minutes stories. There was some town or some city where some combination of nutrition, light, circadian rhythm, something that all kind of... Did you know that I once wrote a TV show on circadian rhythms?
You?
Yeah.
Really?
Again, again, Needham High School, 7th grade.
Amazing.
By the way, we have Dr. Leif Oxberg here. One final question I have, and this has been fascinating. We'd love to have you come back. We talked about the flu and the flu birds early on in the program. Talk a little bit, and again, I admittedly, it's not your core practice or research focus, but antibiotics. And it feels like every time there's a major story on antibiotics, it's kind of fear-based, where we have the human body was designed, and through millions of years of evolution, that we've evolved, whether it's having two kidneys because that's really important. We have a blood-based circulation system, so making sure the filtration happens is important. But in the modern era of antibiotics, it feels like we're impacting the body in ways that is happening in a very small period of time relative to evolution, and that we keep reading about how the body is becoming more resistant to different antibiotics, and whether it's flu mutating into different virus and in response to vaccinations. What do you think, as a scientist, is kind of the state of both an American and worldwide antibiotic research? And are we going down a funnel where there'll be fewer and fewer options for antibiotics, or will science just keep evolving along with it and new breakthroughs will happen? Because it feels like when we lose antibiotics as an effective kind of defense against the world around us, then that's really serious.
It is really serious. And I think the science is keeping up. One of the problems, one of the reasons that antibiotic resistance is such a problem, is the bacteria who we're targeting with the antibiotics, you know, Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, for example, and E. coli, they have the capacity to pass genes around between them in a sort of reproductive way. And so they can pass these resistance genes around. And tuberculosis is a prime example of that, in which, you know, they're multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. And one of the problems there has been that new antibiotic development, although there's a science to it and there are new antibiotics, the drug companies have not really seen it as a very profitable line. So the problem, I think, with development of new antibiotics is maybe not so much the science, but the commercialization of it.
Right.
And solving that problem is hard, I think, because these, you know, everything that comes to market costs $1 billion to develop.
Right.
And that's one of the basic reasons that we don't have more and newer antibiotics, I think.
Well, I would love to have you come back, Dr. Oxberg. This has been fascinating, and I think the work that you're doing is noble, and I wish you all the luck for you and your colleagues.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. We'll be back next Saturday. Thank you.